Everyone needs red t-shirts. The staff hurried to comply, bringing in red Palazzo tourist shirts for the room of about 20 people, including Joey McFarland and Riza Aziz. My friend couldn't even watch, said one young woman who was in attendance that night. He saw on that table all the money he would ever make in his life, his college tuition, car, home, everything, won and lost. It was typical Lowe, who on another drunk occasion had dropped $50,000 worth of casino chips on the floor, only recovering them when a shocked friend noticed the loss. As the night of gambling at the Palazzo wound up at sunrise, Lowe handed the casino staff a tip of $1 million, one of the largest ever at the establishment. Ho K. Tot, in April, wrote a strident column in The Edge calling on 1MDB to name the fund manager looking after its $2.3 billion in the Cayman Islands, and to bring the money home. Then, in May, a Singapore newspaper, citing inside sources, named Hong Kong-based Bridge Global as the fund manager. When Lobo Lee later erased details, including his name, from Bridge Global's website, the newspaper noted the suspicious behavior. Lowe was furious. He believed there was a leak at BSI, and he ordered the bank to hunt down the source. The suspicion fell first on Kevin Swampile, Yo's boss, and Lowe made efforts to get him off the 1MDB-related accounts. Swampile denied any involvement and refused to budge. Over the summer, Lowe lurched from party to party, spending his days railing against unnamed leakers. The facade of carefree revelry was starting to crumble as Lowe became paranoid about a Judas in his ranks. Around this time, he persuaded Yeo Jia Wei, the funds expert at BSI, to come work for him. Yeo accepted. From this point on, Lowe didn't even want to speak on the phone or use email for important transactions, and he planned to tap Yeo's financial expertise, as well as having him courier top-secret documents around the world. The following spring, Lowe would invite Yeo to watch Floyd Mayweather Jr. fight Manny Pacquiao at the MGM Grand Garden Arena in Vegas, and the young Singaporean became hooked on the jet-set lifestyle. His proximity to Lowe had swelled Yeo's self-regard, and he sneered at those at BSI who didn't travel everywhere by private jet. He already had made millions of dollars, secretly funneling off fees paid by 1MDB to BSI and Bridge Global to manage the Cayman Islands' money and other investments. He began to buy multiple homes in Singapore and one in Australia. Now, Lowe enticed him into his inner circle with promises of even more bountiful riches. Yeo would pocket tens of millions of dollars more, but it came at a price, as Lowe morphed into a tyrannical and insecure boss. The banker stayed in contact with former colleagues at BSI, telling them stories about how Lowe would take calls on his private jet and start screaming. He was especially perturbed by details coming out about the Cayman Islands investment. Scared by the way Lowe was acting, so at odds with the mild manners he knew, Yeo began to believe his new boss was losing control. Addressing 1MDB's board in July, Tim Leissner was doing the best he could to keep Goldman in the game to win the IPO business. The fund was in grave danger. In just 2 months, it had lost $140 million under the weight of hundreds of millions of dollars in interest costs. The fund needed an IPO of its energy assets, and quickly, to restore it to health. For 2 years, Leissner had championed the IPO, but now he faced a problem. As part of the deal in 2012 to acquire Ananda Krishnan's power plants, 1MDB had given the billionaire the right to subscribe to the IPO at a cheap price. Now, Leissner was explaining to 1MDB's board how it would cost the fund hundreds of millions of dollars to buy back these rights ahead of the listing. Some board members were outraged. The original deal seemed way too favorable to Krishnan, who already had received above-market prices for his power assets. Some board members knew about secret charity payments of hundreds of millions of dollars by Krishnan-controlled companies to 1MDB, That was how run-of-the-mill graft worked in Malaysia. The government overpaid for an asset, and the seller made backhand contributions to UMNO, while politicians lined their pockets. Still, the terms seemed very good for Krishnan and his company Tanjong. "Is Goldman acting for 1MDB or Tanjong?" Ashvin Valiram, a Malaysian textile entrepreneur and board member, asked Leisner. "Of course, we're representing 1MDB," the banker replied, trying to keep the atmosphere light. "Without this deal with Tanjong, the fund won't be able to undertake the IPO." Finally, ties between Goldman and 1MDB were starting to fray. Earlier in the year, 1MDB had enticed banks to lend even more by offering them a role leading the IPO. The fund had secured a $250 million loan from a consortium led by Deutsche Bank, whose new country head, Yusuf Yakub, had been at Goldman. Finally, another bank was getting a look in. Goldman itself, worried by the negative articles and focus in the Wall Street Journal on its huge profits, began to distance itself from the fund, and was not keen to get entangled in fresh lending. Leisner was furious when 1MDB selected Deutsche and Maybank to run the IPO, a lucrative assignment for both banks, and he turned to Joe Lowe to ensure a role for Goldman. In the end, 1MDB appointed the bank as an advisor for the IPO. At this juncture, Leisner was unsupervised, traveling the world and spending large chunks of time in the United States with his new wife, Kimora Lee Simmons. The banker, through a limited liability company, put down $19 million over the summer for a base on New York's Upper East Side, a 4,600-square-foot, five-bedroom apartment in the Marquand, a 1913 Beaux-Arts building just a stone's throw from Central Park. But he spent as much time in Los Angeles at Simmons's Beverly Hills mansion and flying to Asia. The following year, a British Virgin Islands company that Leisner controlled acquired the Cy Ram, a $20 million, 170-foot yacht with six cabins. For years, Leisner had resented that Goldman never promoted him to a regional role, a consequence of his reputation as a cowboy who wouldn't hesitate to bypass internal permissions to get deals done. But in June, Goldman appointed him chairman of Southeast Asia. He was making too much money for the firm, and there were fears he might walk to another bank, taking his Southeast Asian relationships with him. Later in the year, Lloyd Blankfein, eager for Goldman to continue building its presence in emerging markets, held Leisner and Andrea Vella up as models to follow. "Look at what Tim and Andrea did in Malaysia," Blankfein told a meeting in New York on how to build business in growth markets, rather than the increasingly heavily regulated U.S. "We have to do more of that." Blankfein, Cohn, and other Goldman leaders, in the aftermath of the mortgage crisis, had pledged to put clients first and regularly preached good governance. Yet Goldman had made hundreds of millions of dollars, and 1MDB was in disarray, at a high cost to Malaysia's people. The bank had turned a blind eye to irregularities, enabling the kind of industrial-scale corruption carried out in the past by Sani Abacha of Nigeria or Ferdinand Marcos of the Philippines. Those dictators had been crude. Abacha had sent trucks to loot cash from the central bank. But this was simply a more sophisticated way of taking money, one conducted under the noses of Goldman Sachs. Leisner wasn't the only one interested in boats. Even as his scheme was starting to unravel, Lowe was making his biggest purchase yet. There was one asset he didn't yet possess, a mega yacht. Since the previous year, Ocean Co., a Dutch builder of custom yachts, had been constructing a 300-foot vessel for Lowe, complete with a helicopter landing pad, gymnasium, cinema, sauna, and steam room. This wasn't going to match the Topaz, but it was still one of the most luxurious yachts in the world, and Lowe would be spared the ignominy of renting again from Sheikh Mansour and other tycoons. As the shipbuilders were putting the finishing touches to the yacht at the Alblasserdam shipyard near Rotterdam over the spring, Lowe peppered Ocean co-executives with demands to ensure every element was just so. In the same way he curated his parties, with performances, food, and drink organized down to the most minute detail, Lowe wanted this boat to be perfect. For owner's cabin, perhaps if you can get expert advice from Tempur specialists, which is the most top-of-the-line and expensive, with most functions for mattress, Lowe wrote in one email. All those years ago in Penang, Lowe had borrowed a boat and pretended it was his family's. Now, this yacht would deepen the mystique of a little-known Asian billionaire, and keep hold of Miranda Kerr. Perhaps there was another reason. The yacht could be moved anywhere in an emergency. Now, Lowe needed $250 million to pay Ocean Co., and he had so many other financing requirements that he was starting to get reckless. Deutsche Bank's recent loan to 1MDB was meant to pave the way for the IPO of 1MDB's power assets. In 2012, the fund's management, without the board's knowledge, granted ABAR, the Abu Dhabi fund, options to buy cheap shares in the IPO. It was supposedly a reward for its parent IPIC's guarantee of 1MDB bonds, the payoff that Sheikh Mansour had been promised 2 years earlier. Ahead of the listing, 1MDB's management claimed it needed to buy ABAR's options back at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars, and Deutsche provided the money. Of course, ABAR's chief executive, Mohammed al-Husseini, and chairman, Kadem al-Kubaisi, were conspirators. The options were just another ruse by Lowe to move money around. As soon as 1MDB got its hands on the Deutsche Bank loan, the fund's management sent the money to the look-alike ABAR, the same vehicle Lowe and al-Kubaisi had used to divert cash in 2012. At this critical stage, Lowe could have deployed these funds to fill financial holes, especially the non-existent cash in the Cayman Islands. Instead, he used the bulk of the money to pay for the superyacht, which was delivered in the summer. At this late stage, with politicians and journalists clamoring for the Cayman Islands' money to be returned to Malaysia, it was irrational to be exacerbating the financial damage at the fund. After years of getting away with the scheme, Lowe was blinded to the peril he faced. The first party on the yacht, complete with a dragon-shaped cake provided by Ocean Co., was a birthday celebration that summer for Mei Lin, Lowe's sister. He christened his new yacht Equanimity, meaning calmness and composure, especially in a difficult situation. Part 4. Bonfire of Secrets. Chapter 39. No cash, no deal. Bangkok, Thailand, June 2014. Claire Rucastle Brown, who ran the Sarawak Report blog, looked across the lobby of the Plaza Athanae Hotel in central Bangkok for her contact. She was scanning for a Swiss man in his 40s, and apart from those meager details, knew only the name and title. Xavier Justo, a former employee of PetroSaudi. When a bronzed and muscular figure approached and introduced himself as Justo, she was taken aback. This encounter made even a muckraker like Rucastle Brown nervous. The meeting, in June 2014, had been arranged by an intermediary, and she was expecting a short, bald, bespectacled man. But then, it quickly became apparent that Justo, too, was deeply anxious, and that wasn't the demeanor of someone about to inflict harm. "The people we're dealing with are ruthless and powerful," Justo said. Justo was working on an alternative way to get the money he believed he deserved. Find someone else willing to pay for the PetroSaudi documents he had taken. His connection to Rucastle Brown had been a fortuitous one. After leaving PetroSaudi in 2011, Justo had traveled to Singapore for the city-state's Formula One night race. He was supposed to have met Tarek Obaid, the chief executive of PetroSaudi, there for a negotiation over the files. But his erstwhile friend had not shown up. The trip, however, turned out fruitful in other ways. By chance, he met people close to Mahathir, the former Malaysian prime minister, and had given them his business card. Nothing happened for more than 2 years. Then, in the summer of 2014, those people had connected Justo to Rucastle Brown, who was digging around, trying to find more about 1MDB for her blog. She was eager to have a source with information about PetroSaudi, who she hoped would help her unravel what had transpired at the fund. Before meeting in person, Justo had supplied Rucastle Brown with a sampling of his material. A single piece of paper with the heading, "Thousands of Documents Related to the Deal," emails, faxes, and transcripts, and details of what the server contained. This was just the break she needed to prove her suspicions about 1MDB and Joe Lowe. A few weeks later, she traveled to Bangkok to meet Justo. The server data was ready on a portable hard drive, detailing the PetroSaudi phase of the scheme. But there was a condition. Rucastle Brown had to pay $2 million if she wanted the information. Justo defended the request by explaining this was simply money PetroSaudi owed him. She was a member of Britain's establishment, with a brother-in-law who had been prime minister. But unlike Malaysia, that didn't grant her access to millions of dollars. Justo was adamant. No cash, no deal. Keen to get her hands on the documents, Rucastle Brown set about finding someone who could pay. It would take her 7 months to secure a benefactor. Lowe must have heard from the PetroSaudi executives about Justo's demands for money, but he had no idea about this dangerous meeting between Justo and Rucastle Brown. What would he have done if he did know? It was as if Lowe didn't take Justo seriously. He could easily have arranged for a payoff of a measly few million dollars to the former PetroSaudi executive. But Lowe didn't seem interested in attending to the nuts and bolts of his scheme. He was too taken with his new love interest to focus on the mundane business of ensuring crucial information didn't leak out. Wearing a green skirt and shirt with purple floral patterns, Miranda Kerr stepped from the car in Munich and, as a small group of photographers snapped her picture, made her way into a branch of Escada. It was July 29th, 2014, a hot Bavarian summer's day, and she was there to launch Joyful, a new perfume line for the luxury German fashion brand. The scent was meant to evoke simplicity, and Kerr's makeup was light, her brown hair falling naturally over her shoulders. As German models and television personalities drank champagne and chatted, there was a flurry of activity around Kerr, the kind that attended her wherever she traveled.
"Simple things like, you know, a fresh bouquet of flowers makes me really happy, watching the sunrise or the sunset," she told one interviewer.
In the past few weeks, Kerr's life had been anything but simple. Britain's Daily Mail, Hello Magazine, and many other publications were speculating about a burgeoning romance between the model and James Packer, the Australian gambling billionaire. In June, Australian newspapers noted Kerr had been aboard Packer's superyacht, Arctic P, off the coast of Cyprus, and cited inside sources saying that, rather than a romance, she was looking to get the mogul to invest in Cora Organics. Her current investors, with a 25% stake, were the twin sons of René Rifkin, an Australian stockbroker who had been jailed for insider trading and later took his own life. But the model had grander ambitions for her company, which specialized in organic cosmetics, and she needed a big capital injection. The speculation, however, was focused on the wrong billionaire. As Kerr finished up her work in Munich, Joe Lowe had arranged for a private jet to pick her up and whisk her to Naples in Italy. He had been planning this trip for over a month, even hiring a high-end concierge service to choreograph every element. Lowe ordered his new yacht, Equanimity, piloted by British and American captains, to sail to the waters around Italy. With its Asian-inspired interior, constructed out of wood, bamboo, marble, and gold leaf, the boat helped Lowe stand out from the merely wealthy. It could accommodate 26 guests, but had even more berths for 28 crew members, ensuring a sufficient staff-to-guest ratio. It would cost millions of dollars a year just to operate. This trip was to be much more intimate, although Kerr, as ever, was accompanied by her publicist, Crystal Fox. Billionaires are today's royalty, and like a modern-day Louis XIV, Lowe thrived at being the center of orchestrated formality. Each of his whims met immediately, whether by boat staff, private bankers, or art dealers. A few days earlier, Lowe had taken delivery from Lorraine Schwartz of a matching set of jewelry, comprising diamond earrings, a necklace, a bracelet, and a ring. A few weeks earlier, he'd sent Schwartz a picture of Kerr wearing Tiffany jewelry to give her an idea of the model's taste. Over the next 10 days on the boat, as it sailed around Italy and to the Greek island of Corfu, Lowe gave the various pieces of jewelry to Kerr over elaborate set dinners. Yet Lowe was straining to pay for all this opulence. Although some $5 billion had come out of 1MDB, the scheme had so many tendrils, so many payments to conspirators and business partners. And to keep up a billionaire's lifestyle, he was often hustling for cash. Recently, he had hired U.S. public relations firm Edelman to help counter the growing number of negative press stories about him, and he would later employ Shillings, the British reputation consultancy. Edelman's services were costing him as much as $100,000 some months. As bills piled up, Lowe began to miss payments, including legal bills and salaries for the crew of Equanimity, forcing him to use his vast art collection as collateral for a loan from Sotheby's Financial. To pay the $2 million invoice on Kerr's latest jewelry, Lowe again raided the fund. As he was such an important customer, Schwartz permitted him to pay a few months after the Corfu trip. But by September, he needed to send the cash. Given how much he had taken from 1MDB, Lowe seemingly could have financed this relatively small amount from some pot of money somewhere in the world. Instead, he was seized by the need to get as much out of 1MDB as he could, perhaps believing the upcoming IPO would keep the edifice from collapsing. He had already taken money from a Deutsche Bank loan to 1MDB in May, a late-stage flow of money that could have gone to shore up 1MDB's finances, and spent it on the Equanimity. Now, he set about trying to get a further $725 million in loans from Deutsche, ostensibly for the same reason. Ahead of the IPO, 1MDB needed to pay off ABAR to cancel even more options that allowed it to take a stake in the listing. Given the profits Goldman had made from 1MDB, Deutsche Bank was keen, but it couldn't muster this money alone. To rally other Middle Eastern banks to take part, Lowe wrote Ambassador Oteba on September 10, 2014, using the Eric Tan Gmail account, requesting him to use his sway in Abu Dhabi to get other lenders on board. The ambassador duly obliged and wrote the managing director of First Gulf Bank, which along with Abu Dhabi Commercial Bank and a Kuwaiti lender, joined a consortium led by Deutsche Bank. Goldman looked at taking part, but finally, after a number of years of obliviousness, the bank had questions about the fund's behavior and backed out. As collateral for the loan, 1MDB had posted its $2.3 billion Cayman Islands investment. But the fund's executives, when pushed by Goldman bankers, had been unable to show proof it existed. Just a guarantee from the Abu Dhabi fund, ABAR. Mohammed Al-Husseini, ABAR's chief executive, helped the process along, urging Deutsche Bank employees to disperse the new loan quickly. Another Lowe associate, Terence Gay, a finance executive at 1MDB, also pushed Deutsche Bank to hurry up, citing Prime Minister Najib's desire to receive the money expeditiously. Then, 1MDB requested Deutsche Bank send the first tranche of the $725 million loan directly to ABAR. It was an odd arrangement. Normally a bank, for compliance reasons, would send such large amounts of cash directly to the borrower. But Deutsche was satisfied by the apparent involvement of the Abu Dhabi fund. The perpetrators had tricked the bank. The recipient was another look-alike Abar, set up by Al-Husseini with an account at UBS Bank in Singapore. 2 days later, more than $100 million was diverted to a shell company controlled by Fat Eric. It became clear from what occurred next why Lo needed to keep pilfering the till. There were just so many people to repay for their services. The shell company sent $13 million to Densmore, a British Virgin Islands firm partially controlled by Oteba, which had an account at BSI in Singapore, an apparent reward for using his ambassadorial position to help get the Middle Eastern banks on board. Kadem Al-Kubaisi, who was Al-Husseini's boss, got $15 million. And Lo, of course, took his cut, sending some of the money to Lorraine Schwartz. A few months later, he would buy Kerr yet more jewelry, a $3.8 million diamond pendant, making a grand total of over $8 million to acquire the supermodel's affections. In September 2014, Mahathir Mohamad, the 89-year-old former prime minister of Malaysia, who remained a powerful figure in the ruling UMNO party, received a dossier of leaked information, including emails from 1MDB that showed Joe Lo was involved in investment decisions. After years of speculation about his role at the fund, here was proof. Mahathir still wielded power at UMNO, and he began to engage in backroom dealing intended to force Prime Minister Najib to resign over this mess. The fund's huge debt risked toppling Malaysia into a crisis like Argentina, Mahathir wrote on his blog. This was not The Edge, a scrappy newspaper, but one of the nation's most powerful figures raising concerns about 1MDB. Until now, journalists had only been able to speculate about Lo and the source of his wealth. To counter the stories, Edelman, the public relations firm, put out a statement denying their client had received patronage from Malaysia's government. But now, solid information was starting to leak out from the troubled sovereign wealth fund. Claire Rucastle Brown at Sarawak Report, who also got hold of the emails, published a piece titled Joe Lo's Spending and Malaysia's Development Money, in which she questioned why the fund had lied about Lo's secret role. Malaysians are entitled to conclude that Lo's record levels of spending in various billionaire hotspots, she wrote, has largely been paid for by them. At Deloitte's offices in Kuala Lumpur, the developments sparked panic. Its auditors were rushing to sign off on the accounts for the financial year to March 2014, which under Malaysian law were supposed to be submitted by the end of September. The fund had never managed this in the past, but now a timely submission was crucial to getting the IPO underway by the year-end. Concerned about its reputation, Deloitte was demanding a quick repatriation of the $2.3 billion in the Cayman Islands Fund. The 1MDB board, apparently under the illusion there was money there, upped the entreaties on management to comply. Since first taking cash from 1MDB, Lo had relied on accounting magic to make this problem disappear. But through three different auditing firms, there it remained, like a pebble in his shoe. Before, he'd gone on taking more and spending wildly, seemingly under the assumption he could cover it up with new trickery down the road. Now, as his desperation mounted, Lo was coming to a stark realization. He would have to give up some real funds. The trouble was, he didn't have $2.3 billion at his disposal. He had to find another maneuver, and it would be his most reckless yet. Turning to Yeo Jae-wei, the former BSI fund specialist, Lo looked for a way out. How could they turn a few $100 million, the remainder of the Deutsche Bank money not used for jewelry and other purchases, into $2.3 billion? This kind of alchemy was beyond even Lo, but accounting tricks had worked for years to hide his thefts from 1MDB, so why not one last monumental sleight of hand to fool Deloitte and the board? Yeo had an idea, and he looked to Amicorp, the Singapore-based financial company that administered funds in Curaçao, to put it into practice. To make it look like 1MDB was bringing the money home, Yo devised a complex and circuitous flow of payments. It was the craziest plan to date. So outlandish, it appeared to have no chance of success. The idea was to transfer a portion of cash from the latest Deutsche Bank loan into the Cayman Islands Fund. From there, 1MDB would then redeem this money, but immediately send it into a series of offshore vehicles set up by Amicorp, until the cash ended up back at the Cayman Islands Fund. From here, 1MDB could again redeem the money. It was the same cash going in circles. The perpetrators sent a chunk of a few $100 million through this cycle, and then repeated the process 5 more times, making it look as if 1MDB had redeemed $1.5 billion of its non-existent Cayman Islands investment. Satisfied by the money coming home, Deloitte, in early November, signed off on 1MDB's accounts. The auditor had missed the circuitous movement of cash. The fund had made over a $200 million loss, which was unlikely to entice investors to take part in the IPO, but it appeared to have quieted its critics. In a statement, 1MDB announced it had redeemed over half of the money in the Cayman Islands. Lowe looked to have performed a miracle, and perhaps the IPO would proceed, but there was still a problem. Deutsche Bank had noticed something wasn't right, pushing Lowe further into a corner. Some bankers at Deutsche were suspicious about the Cayman Islands investment, the collateral for its loan. If the German bank asked for its money back, the investment fund would have been unable to come up with the cash. The Malaysian needed some good publicity, and like many disreputable businessmen, he looked to philanthropy for a quick fix boost to his image. It was a sign of growing desperation. Chapter 40. Generous Joe. New York, October 2014. As Alicia Keys and her husband, Swizz Beatz, introduced him, Lowe rose from his seat and made for the lectern at Cipriani Wall Street. Fervent applause rang out for the Malaysian, who was being honored at one of the highlights of New York's social calendar, the Angel Ball. A yearly event organized by Denise Rich, a socialite and songwriter whose daughter Gabrielle had died of cancer. It attracted Hollywood stars, musicians, and business titans, and raised millions to fight the disease. A few months earlier, Rich had telephoned Lowe to inform him he would be honored as that year's Angel Gabrielle at a ball on October 19th. Dressed in black tie, Lowe took to the stage on the evening of the gala, and as the applause died out, he paused a moment to look out across the room. The banquet hall had once been home to the New York Stock Exchange, and its Greek pillars and high ceilings, centered around an imposing Wedgwood dome, exuded power and status. Lowe could see many people he knew well and counted as friends. There was Rich herself, whose former husband, Mark Rich, had fled to Switzerland after being indicted on federal charges of tax evasion, eventually being granted a pardon by President Bill Clinton. Nearby were Ambassador Oteba and his wife, who also were being honored as Angels of Inspiration for their charity work. Sitting across from the pair was Jamie Foxx, who later that evening would perform, as would Alicia Keys and Ludacris. Lorraine Schwartz, too, was on hand, as were Paris Hilton and Richie Akiva, owner of One Oak, a New York nightclub frequented by Lowe. He began by telling the story of how, in February 2012, he'd undertaken his first ever full-body medical checkup in Switzerland, only for a doctor to tell him he might have stage 2 lung cancer. "I felt my world fall apart," Lowe said, sounding a bit stiff, as if trying to make sure he got the story right. "This was one of the changing moments of my life, and I didn't know what to do." He related how he had called Al-Husseini, gesturing to his friend in the audience, who had connected him with a doctor at the University of Texas's MD Anderson Cancer Center, one of the world's top hospitals for treating the disease. After 6 months of tests, the doctors told him it was only an infection. The reprieve from cancer changed his outlook on life, Lo said, and later that year he set up the Jinwell Foundation to make charity a bigger part of his life. The following year, in October 2013, Lo pledged $50 million to MD Anderson to fund an effort to better diagnose cancer by feeding patient data into IBM's Watson supercomputer. Here was Lo, caught on camera, carrying on as he had for his entire life. The master storyteller mixing reality with half-truths, all in the service of distracting anyone from looking deeper. What you claimed to be, you were. Plain and simple. Perhaps Lo had been worried about dying of cancer, but he used the speech to develop another fiction, one about his origins. "I'd like to take this opportunity to tell New York a bit about my background," he said. Some in the audience groaned inwardly as the speech went on and on. But Lo needed to make his moment count. He spun once again the old story of his grandfather, who had come to Malaysia in the 1960s and built a fortune. Only now he told this story to an audience that included luminaries of New York business and entertainment. His grandfather, Lo said, had started the Lo tradition of philanthropy, giving to communities across Asia, including to orphans. He recently had died, also of cancer, which Lo said had inspired him to donate to MD Anderson. "Everything he stood for inspires me every day," Lo said. The grandfather had died. Lo undoubtedly loved him, but he was not as wealthy or such a philanthropist as his grandson made out. Neither was Lo himself so charitable. The Jinwell Foundation had done little through 2012. While Lo was busy raiding the 1MDB fund, even during his own cancer scare. It was true that the Jinwell Foundation had pledged more than $100 million to charities, although it had actually paid out only a fraction of that amount. Its activity began to pick up only in late 2013, just as negative media stories about Lo were snowballing, and more so in 2014. In order to change the narrative, Edelman counseled Lo to publicize his charitable endeavors, including pledges of tens of millions of dollars to National Geographic's Pristine Seas Endeavor and to the United Nations to save its news service from closure. Lo was even planning to donate to his alma mater. At his request, an architect drew up plans for a new building at Wharton to be called the Jinwell Institute for Sustainable Business. Lo was planning to make a $150 million commitment to build and operate the institute over 30 years. A munificent gesture, redolent of a Rockefeller or a Carnegie. Lo looked to have a handle on the situation, with Deloitte signing off on 1MDB's accounts, an IPO in the cards, and the rosy glow of a big philanthropic award. He arranged for Jinwell to make a snazzy corporate video. In the video, Thomas Kaplan, a U.S. businessman in whose New York financial firm Jinwell had invested $150 million, extolled Lo for always standing by his promises. There were also cameos by Sen Lo, Alicia Keys, and a top Mubadala executive. "How do you quantify luxury and inspire synergies that create value for everyone, whilst building trust and loyalty for a lifetime?" a narrator says breathlessly during the video, filmed in Abu Dhabi, New York, and the Caribbean. For Jinwell, dynamic quality, exciting value creation, and loyal trust are the foundation. Nothing slips beneath. Lo even was in talks for what would have been his biggest corporate deal yet, a €1 billion bid alongside Mubadala to buy Reebok, the Boston-based sports apparel company, from Adidas. Called Project Turbocharged at Jinwell, Lo's firm, the acquisition would seal his name as a gold-plated investor. Swizz Beatz, who had a creative role at Reebok, was involved in the deal. The Malaysian traveled to Boston for negotiations, staying for weeks in a suite at the Four Seasons.
He also began talks with Tom Ford, the U.S. fashion designer who makes suits for James Bond, to take a 25% stake in his company. These were high-profile deals aimed at drowning out the increasingly loud noise about Lowe's past. But he would not have time to finalize the negotiations. Back home in Malaysia, Prime Minister Najib's secret accounts were finally attracting some scrutiny, and Lowe was forced to hustle to stop a nosy Australian bank from getting in his way. Chapter 41. Sacks of Money. Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, December 2014. In early December, Joanna Yu, the AmBank employee who ran Prime Minister Najib's secret accounts, was in a panic. "Very stressful these days. ANZ running the bank," she texted to Joe Lowe, referring to the Australian bank that held a stake in AmBank. "We need to close the accounts soonest, please," she said. Lowe texted back, "Okay," but seemed distracted. And as the month wore on and the accounts remained open, Yu got increasingly worried. In a series of messages, she explained to Lowe how the situation was perilous. Chia Tek Kwong, the chief executive who had given cover to the enterprise, had stepped down to take on an advisory role. The new chief, Ashok Ramamurti, was an appointee from ANZ, and he'd found out about Najib's secret business. By now, the prime minister had a number of accounts at AmBank, and Ramamurti was watching. Late in 2014, the new chief executive became fretful about a series of huge cash payments into Najib's accounts. In the last few months, the prime minister had been running short on funds as he paid off politicians. Desperate to stop the accounts from becoming overdrawn, which would attract attention from compliance, Lowe arranged for an associate to make last-minute cash deposits, taking sacks of cash into an AmBank branch. It was a huge miscalculation and alarmed Yu, who pleaded with Lowe to stop. Heedless of the advice, he kept sending the associate with sacks of cash, literally bundles of notes in bags, to AmBank branches. The deposits totaled only $1.4 million, but handing money over the counter like this had set off anti-money laundering alerts at AmBank, and Ramamurti was forced to act. The chief executive alerted the AmBank board and Bank Negara Malaysia, the central bank. Lowe was furious. "This is confidential," he replied, ordering Yu to tell Chia Tek Kwong to stop Ramamurti from further disclosures. "It was too late," she replied. "ANZ board members knew about the account now, and Chia, who saw the writing on the wall, was retiring from the bank at the end of December." At ANZ headquarters in Melbourne, Australia, overlooking the city's former docks, executives were disturbed by what they were finding out. It was a potential public relations disaster for ANZ, which was the largest single shareholder in the bank. Ramamurti had been with the Australian bank for more than two decades, and Shane Elliott, ANZ's finance director and one of Australia's most senior bankers, even sat on AmBank's board. The bank had wanted to tap into Malaysia's growth, like many foreign retail banks that expanded in emerging markets during this period. But ANZ clearly had no idea about what had transpired at a bank it was supposed to control. It wasn't just a question of Najib's accounts. AmBank also had been lending to 1MDB, and the news stories about the fund were making ANZ executives nervous. To limit the potential damage, the board ordered AmBank to immediately drop out of any work on the IPO, which it was co-arranging with Deutsche and Maybank. The revelations were also a dilemma for Bank Negara Malaysia. The central bank oversaw the country's financial system, and it had failed to uncover one of the world's biggest financial swindles. Chia had informed Zeti Akhtar Aziz, the 67-year-old governor of Bank Negara, about the prime minister's account in 2011. He told her Najib was expecting inflows of hundreds of millions of dollars in political donations from Saudi Arabia, a story concocted by Lowe to explain the torrent of cash. That was the last Zeti had heard of the matter.
It was a delicate situation, as it involved the Prime Minister, but Zeti now ordered an internal review of his accounts. For more than a decade, she had been at the helm of Bank Negara Malaysia and was regarded as one of Asia's most skillful central bankers. This issue threatened her reputation, and she wanted to get to the bottom of it. As the stress mounted, Yu was looking to change banks herself, scared about this scrutiny from ANZ and the central bank. Protected in his bubble, served by sycophants, low foremost among them, Najib was among the few who didn't know the noose was tightening, and he ordered that his accounts remain open. The Prime Minister needed to keep his wife happy. Just before Christmas, Najib, accompanied by Rosma and their usual retinue of hangers-on and security, flew into Honolulu, the state capital of Hawaii, aboard a Malaysian government jet. Days later, the pair breezed into a Chanel store in Honolulu's upscale Ala Moana Center. The First Lady perused the jewelry and bags on display. Lo had provided Rosma with a $27.3 million jewel from Lorraine Schwartz, but for more mundane purchases, those costing only a few $100,000, she relied on Najib's credit cards. In the Chanel store, her items selected, Rosma turned to Najib to pay. The Prime Minister whipped out his platinum credit card with a $1 million limit and handed it to the cashier. A moment later, a nervous Chanel employee informed Najib that the transaction was not going through. Annoyed, he tapped out a message to Lo on his cell phone. The credit card drew from his AmBank accounts, which were funded by 1MDB money. "My platinum cards are not going through, Joe. Can you call AmBank Visa and MasterCard right away?" he wrote. Lo messaged Joanna Yu, who reassured him the Prime Minister's limit was still $1 million. After an awkward wait in the Chanel store, eventually the credit card machine burst into action, charging the Malaysian people another $130,625 for Rosma's frivolity. It was just a drop in the ocean of her spending. Months earlier, on the Italian island of Sardinia, Najib had used his card to acquire 750,000 euros in jewelry for his wife. Since 2008, Rosma had spent at least $6 million using credit cards, her husband's, but also others in her own name, in a non-stop round of shopping stretching from Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills to Harrods in Knightsbridge to Saks on Fifth Avenue. In private, she thought nothing of using government jets for her shopping trips. But after the Bercy anti-graft protests in 2012 had targeted Rosma's spending, she went on a public relations campaign to improve her image. Her wealth, she said, was due to a lifelong habit of saving. "I have bought some jewelry and dresses with my own money. What is wrong with that?" she wrote in an autobiography. But Malaysians weren't so easily fooled. She said she saved that money since she was small. "That is impossible," said Anis Siafika Mod Yusuf, a 24-year-old student from the University of Malaya, who organized a small protest against corruption, one of the many around this period. In online blog posts, average Malaysians derided the First Family for their extravagant lifestyle. One site collected pictures of Rosma with multiple Birkin bags. Those who protested did so at great personal risk, even of jail time. But the egregious corruption of this regime was becoming too much for many people to bear silently. As Rosma shopped, Najib had other business to transact in Hawaii. 2 days later, on Christmas Eve, the Prime Minister met President Obama for a round of golf. Unaware of the trouble facing Lo, Najib saw the chance to play the president as a triumph, another sign of his growing power and stature on a world stage. It was a rare honor. Obama golfed with British Prime Minister David Cameron and Vice President Joe Biden, but few foreign leaders had been given the chance. To underscore his support of Najib, Obama had agreed to a round at the Kaneohe Clipper Golf Course, just a short drive from where the president was vacationing with his family. Despite the protests against Najib, Obama continued to view him as among the United States' best allies in Asia. But the round ended on an anticlimax. On the 18th green, Obama made his first putt. As he struck, it was clear the ball was moving to the left of the hole. The president moved to tap the ball in, but picked it up before it missed again. Prime Minister Najib then stepped up, but he also missed a second putt. Obama consoled him with a pat on the shoulder, and the two leaders moved toward the clubhouse. By December, Deutsche Bank was perturbed. The bank had dreamed of replicating Goldman's profits, but instead, it was now dawning on executives that 1MDB had something to hide. Deutsche had lent hundreds of millions of dollars to the fund, which was obligated, as part of the loan agreements, to hand over financial information to the bank. But Terence Gay, the fund's finance executive, was refusing to cooperate. The bank particularly wanted details on the Cayman Islands investment, which was collateral for the loans. The money was supposedly held by Brazen Sky, the 1MDB affiliate, at an account at BSI in Singapore, but Gay declined to hand any data over, citing government secrecy. If Deutsche found out there was no money there, it would recall its loans, plunging 1MDB into further financial distress and scuttling the IPO, which Deutsche was helping arrange. The 1MDB board also was anxious. In December, the fund's offices had received a visit from police after a UMNO politician close to Mahathir had made a complaint about possible fraud at the fund. They had gone away without taking documents, but the raid spooked one board member, who worried aloud whether they could all be prosecuted for criminal breach of trust. Deutsche Bank was not buying Gay's excuses. And just before Christmas Day in 2014, Lowe took a drastic step, ordering senior executives at the fund to destroy all documents at 1MDB's headquarters in Kuala Lumpur. Lowe was a phantom presence at 1MDB, rarely in the offices, but exerting his power through executives who would carry out his wishes without question. Most of the smart Ivy Leaguers had left amid concerns about Lowe. Those who remained were loyalists. This demand, however, to erase the data of a multi-billion-dollar sovereign wealth fund, reeked of desperation. Lower-level employees were told to bring their laptops and cell phones to the IT department, where staff wiped them clear of all data. Even information on the fund's mainframe computer was obliterated. As an excuse, executives told staff there had been a hacking of 1MDB. That was how Sarawak Report had obtained the emails, and this was the only way to ensure security. The action was not rational. A company that's facing a hacking threat can simply take its servers offline. Not long after, the physical servers went missing too. This was an attempt to erase history, and it was a sign Lowe was running out of options. For years, he had thrived, leveraging his proximity to Prime Minister Najib to run 1MDB in secret. Over the years, he exhibited an inhuman tolerance for risk. The flip side was that Lowe rarely looked to the future. He had no contingency plan, no idea of how to get out of this mess, and now he was panicked. But his hapless maneuvering didn't work. There were copies of documents in multiple locations. Justo had access to some key ones, making it impossible for Lowe to smother all traces of the fund's existence. Deutsche Bank kept pushing for documents, and Gay eventually was forced to doctor 1MDB's accounts and Brazen Sky's bank statements at BSI to make it appear the cash was still there. The 1MDB fund's chairman, Lodin Wak Kamarudin, who was in close contact with Najib, informed the board in a meeting on November 25, 2014, that there was no choice but to sell assets and wind down operations as soon as possible. Interest costs alone were more than $800 million per year, and the fund was close to default. The IPO looked ever more like a pipe dream. Before the fund could be wound up, however, Xavier Justo, pulled the trigger. Chapter 42. The Exposé. Singapore, January 2015. Ho Kay Tat strode into the sunlit atrium of the Fullerton Hotel in Singapore, accompanied by his boss, chairman of the Edge Media Group, Tong Kui Ong. The imposing gray granite neoclassical building had served as the scrappy colony's central post office in the 1900s, but was now a well-known five-star hotel at the mouth of the Singapore River, towered over by the glass and steel skyscrapers of the financial district. As the pair entered the Fullerton, Claire Rucastle Brown came over and informed them her contact was waiting in the lounge area. She had briefed them on a source with information on 1MDB, but they had been expecting a Malaysian, and they got a shock when Rucastle Brown led them to Justo, a tall, charming Swiss man sitting in a comfy chair. It was late morning, and over coffees, Justo showed a sampling of the emails from Petro Saudi, repeating his demand for payment of $2 million. "We need to verify the authenticity of the emails first," Ho replied. Although she refused to pay him herself, since meeting Justo, Rucastle Brown had been searching for someone to supply the money. The Edge's publisher, Tong, was an obvious choice. Since founding The Edge 2 decades earlier, Tong had built up a staff of 350 people and a reputation as Malaysia's only true independent newspaper proprietor. He'd agreed to meet Justo and brought along 2 independent IT experts to verify the information. That afternoon, the group reconvened in one of the Fullerton's meeting rooms, where the IT experts pored over Justo's hard disk, taking a few hours to sift through the reams of emails and documents. The experts scoured for evidence of tampering, looking at that hidden metadata within files to ascertain whether anyone had made alterations after the date of creation. Computer users leave a digital fingerprint, and though they could not be 100% sure, the IT experts concluded that, in their opinion, the files had not been tampered with. The group then discussed how to pay Justo. He didn't want cash, and he was worried a large transfer into his accounts might lead to complications with bank compliance executives. He left, agreeing to find a way to receive the money at a later date, but handing over the hard disk. "I trust you," Justo said to the group. Rucastle Brown and Ho Kay Tat had their hands on the journalistic scoops of their careers. Before they had time to sift through the hundreds of thousands of documents provided by Justo, the New York Times published a front-page story on Lo on February 8, 2015. The Times piece, part of a series about dodgy foreign money in the Time Warner building, detailed his accumulation of U.S. properties and painted him as a bagman for the Prime Minister's family, buying apartments and mansions and passing them on to Riza Aziz. It noted how Lo's story had changed from being a concierge for rich friends to being a billionaire claiming that he was investing family money. The Times also pointed out how Red Granite's principals had once put forward Lo as an investor, but of late had started mentioning Al-Husseini. And the newspaper noted Rosma's penchant for expensive jewelry. Neither any money spent on travel, nor any jewelry purchases, nor the alleged contents of any safes are unusual for a person of the Prime Minister's position, responsibility, and legacy family assets, Najib's office said in a statement to the Times. The Times piece rippled through Malaysia, picked up by those news outlets that Najib couldn't control. The statement from the Prime Minister's office was the last straw for Najib's 4 brothers, who for years had complained inside the family about Rosma's spending. The First Lady was increasingly out of touch, a Marie Antoinette-like figure who recently had complained to a public gathering about the $400 it cost to dye her hair, a monthly wage for some Malaysians. The brothers decided to put out a rare statement to counter the inference that their father, Prime Minister Abdul Razak, had taken money while in office. "We take issue with anyone who taints his memory, whatever the motive," the brothers wrote. It was a thinly veiled dig at Najib and Rosma, but it was too late to salvage the family name. In early March, Rue Castle Brown was ready to publish. After years of suspicions about 1MDB and Lowe, her story, posted on February 28th, was headlined, Heist of the Century. And it drew back.